A retired central banker and the president of the World Bank walk into a lecture hall. Hilarity, of course, ensues. Actually, a pretty interesting conversation. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C. today, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, the fourth day of February. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, there is that big speech tonight up on Capitol Hill. President Trump gives his State of the Union address. Democrats on one side of the aisle, Republicans, of course, on the other. I am in town, though, not for that, but for a conversation I had this morning at the Bipartisan Policy Center with Janet Yellen, late of the Federal Reserve. Also, David Malpass, the president of the World Bank. Two people who keep close eye and have some thoughts on the global economy. And I started off with what I grant you was a softball question.
Describe for me this macroeconomic moment. Where are we?
Thanks, softball, slow growth, but that leads to all sorts of conversation. We recently did our global economic prospects report. Mm-hmm. So the bank does twice a year a thick report on growth. And it's looking at 2020, only 2.5% real growth. Some of the developing countries, especially China and a little bit India, are running above that average. But then the U.S. in our forecast was consensus at 1.8%. But Europe is down at 1% only, and Japan at 0.7%. So they drag down the average. Mm-hmm. So that gives you a sense of what's going on in the world, that you've got to get some of the big countries going in order to get people toward prosperity.
Janet, let me ask you this question then. Where are the drivers of growth? I mean, if, as the World Bank says, the United States is going to grow 1.8% this year, are we helping?
So growth in the United States this year is likely to be slower than it was last year and the year before. But likely the U.S. economy is still going to grow at its potential, or maybe even a little bit higher, which in a sense is all that can be expected, especially given how tight the labor market is with the lowest unemployment rate in 50 years. So it shouldn't be surprising to see growth in the United States around 2%. We've had globally a weak global growth is a drag on the U.S., and the U.S. growing slower, of course, is a drag on the global economy. But the driver of growth for the U.S. and in many more developed countries, this is true, that the main driver is the consumer.
Yeah.
The U.S. consumer is strong enough to, I think, propel in the United States growth at a trend-like pace, which is not inappropriate given it means we'll continue to have a very tight labor market and maybe it'll even tighten further.
But let me just follow up really quickly. Don't you worry about consumers getting tired? Because it's been years now that everybody from you on down has been saying, consumers, they're the thing. How much longer can that happen?
Well, consumer spending is in line with income growth. If you contrast the current situation with what we saw before the crisis, in the run-up to the crisis, mm-hmm. consumer spending was also the driver, but it was debt-fueled. We had mm-hmm. a lot of people using their homes like piggy banks. The saving rate had been declining to exceptionally low levels. We've been through a very tough period in the United States in which consumers have worked off debt. And the labor market's been performing exceptionally well. We still have about 180,000 jobs a month. And wage gains are moderate but have picked up yeah. some. And so I don't see the consumer spending that's carrying this economy as based on very weak foundations.
Okay.
It's based on solid growth of income. I see it as sustainable.
David, I cut you off. I apologize. What were you going to say?
That's fine. Just picking up on some of those points. The misery index is way down. And so that gives, if you look at what drives people going forward in businesses to create a new business, it's as people have confidence in the economy. So remember the old misery index, the sum of the unemployment rate and the inflation rate.
Yep.
As the as the unemployment rate has gone down, the participation rate has gone up.
So I get all that, and that's all good, and I appreciate the indicators. But let me pick up on something you said, Janet, which was that the U.S. economy is growing about at its potential, 1.8, maybe 2%. Is it troubling to no one that the potential of the American economy is 2%?
It is troubling that
okay.
it's 2%. It's something that has been long anticipated, so it's not an enormous surprise. Part of it reflects a slowdown in labor force growth. We have an aging population, less immigration. The second piece of it is productivity growth, and it is depressing or of concern that not only in the United States, but in most developed countries, we're simply seeing slower productivity growth than has been the average. Partly, I think it reflects sluggish investment spending. Mm-hmm. Part of it reflects a slowdown in the pace of educational attainment in the United States. But most important, just the pace of technological change seems like it's declined. And there really is no agreement on the reasoning. But, of course, it's of tremendous concern.
I say this mostly just to, I guess there's probably thought bubbles out there, but it's not at all encouraging when a former Fed chair says, I don't know. Right? You know?
It's the truth.
Well, and we'll get back to that in a minute. Very quick change of topic, since you both have brought it up, the recession and the response. The crisis next time, because, of course, there's another recession coming. This expansion is long in the tooth, although it does not, as we all know, die of old age. Coronavirus, does that distress you at all in terms of a global economic shock? I mean, you were just in Hong Kong. You're feeling fine, we should say.
But, so far.
But, you know, so far, great.
See, it's been three
great.
Weeks, so all's good.
All right, good. Are you worried about that? I mean, honestly.
Well, of course, it is a potential influence on the global economy. It seems certain to have a significant effect, you know, at least for a quarter or two on Chinese growth. And China is such a significant piece of the global economy that's bound to have spillovers. Economists have looked at what's happened with past episodes like the SARS virus or the MERS virus. But we don't know where this is going. And, I mean, to my mind, it is clearly a source of uncertainty and risk to the global outlook.
David, the World Bank's position?
Yeah, so there'll be a lowering of forecasts for at least the first part of 2020, in part due to China, but in part due to the supply chains. To give you an example, a lot of Chinese goods come out to the rest of the world in the belly of aircraft that are carrying passengers. So as you cut down on passenger flights, you need to adjust the supply chains in order to get the goods out to make the products that the whole world economy is operating on. A positive side that I bring out is the different science that's available this time than the SARS. So SARS was 2002, 2003. China hadn't released the virus. This time they quickly released the virus. So we have some hope that science response will shorten the full life cycle of this crisis.
Also true, though, that China's more integrated now into the global economy. So that's, you know, the transmission vectors are completely different.
Correct.
David Malpass there, the president of the World Bank. Also Janet Yellen, immediate past chair of the Federal Reserve. More from them later on in the program. Trade will be the topic, by the way. Wall Street. In this post-caucus pre-State of the Union speech session, coronavirus? What coronavirus? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. What we know and what we don't know about the coronavirus, as we just heard from Janet Yellen and David Malpass, is a source of no small concern to economists and epidemiologists alike. Figuring out where the thing is going to go next is the name of the game. And in the middle of this outbreak, AI is making a play. Artificial intelligence companies have crunched a whole lot of data on the coronavirus, identifying early patterns. And as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, they're building predictive models trying to clue us into what might be around the corner.
3 weeks before a top Chinese health official went on TV to announce travel restrictions on Wuhan, medical data nerds halfway across the world were already suggesting an outbreak. The Canadian startup Blue Dot found its computers picked up early warnings from online chatter in China. Blue Dot consultant Isaac Bogosh is a doctor and clinical investigator at the University of Toronto. I caught him on his cell.
Chinese language newspapers had reported on some sick people who may have been associated with a seafood market in Wuhan, and then public health officials discussing meetings between hospitals.
Blue Dot notified the World Health Organization, which issued an early alert. Now, people like Bogosh feed computers all kinds of data. Animal disease info, airline schedules, web articles to find patterns that reveal outbreaks and where they might spread. Even before this coronavirus showed up outside of China, Bogosh had co-authored a short paper predicting it might first go to Thailand or Japan. And days later, the head of respiratory diseases at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, Nancy Messonnier, announced
3 cases outside of China have been identified, 2 in Thailand, 1 in Japan,
yep.
All in travel.
Bogosh was exactly right. How'd he and his team do it? Well, first, they ran the numbers on historical travel patterns.
We looked at commercial flight data just to see where people from Wuhan were going to. In addition to that, we looked at the destinations. You know, what is the capacity of a country to handle an infectious diseases threat?
In other words, places with less developed public health systems have a higher riskiness score. Now, this epidemic early warning system isn't just for governments. Airlines, hotels, cruise lines, they could lose millions of dollars if people stop traveling. The data firm Metabiota has this online ad.
We deliver actionable, data-driven insights that help you manage and mitigate risk.
Metabiota looks at a disease, its symptoms, death rate, whether there's a vaccine, and surveys people on how much that disease scares them. CEO Nina Modhoff says this coronavirus has a pretty high, we'll call it scariness index.
SARS, when that hit China and caused a 30 to 40% loss in revenue, it's actually a very similar score to what we're seeing to the current coronavirus.
Like Blue Dot, her firm uses AI to forecast epidemics. And Modhoff says sometimes she's really confident.
The most powerful information is when the unofficial sources, the official sources are all pointing towards the same sort of picture about what's going on.
But data predictions are only as good as the data. And in this outbreak, some experts worry that China is underreporting cases. Doctors are too busy for patients just mildly ill. Eric Lofgren is a computational epidemiologist at Washington State.
You know, the difference between how big this is going to be, if there's 250 cases versus 500 cases versus 1,000 cases, those are very different numbers early in an epidemic. And those will change the forecasts pretty dramatically.
So there's risk in these prediction models. They could give countries and businesses false confidence that everything is okay, or send false alarms. For what it's worth, a brand new paper co-authored by Isaac Bogosh in Toronto suggests the virus could next go to Turkey, Egypt, or New Zealand. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Everybody knows YouTube. A whole lot of people use YouTube. Not too many of us know the nuts and bolts of YouTube's finances. Alphabet, which owns Google, which in turn owns YouTube, pulled back the curtain just a bit this week, specifically how much money all those videos are bringing in, and it's a lot. $15 billion last year, around 10% of Alphabet's total revenue. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes a look at what else we have learned.
Alphabet finally told everyone how much YouTube was pulling in because it's under a lot of pressure too. Mark Mahaney is managing director at RBC.
Investors have been asking for this exact disclosure for the last several years. Secondly, the SEC in the past has asked them for greater disclosure.
YouTube has more revenue than Viacom and about half as much as Comcast.
Look, we got confirmation last night that YouTube is one of the world's biggest media assets, and it's growing probably around 40% if you include the subscription revenue.
Mahaney says YouTube isn't known for its subscriptions, but they're bringing in $3 billion a year. Colin Sebastian is senior research analyst with RW Baird.
YouTube is a distant cousin, so to speak, to Netflix and Amazon, but they clearly have a fairly robust, albeit still small but fast-growing, subscription business of their own.
One of the big reveals to investors was how much YouTube can still grow. Colin Gillis is director of research at Chatham Road Partners.
The average revenue per user is around that $7.50 level. Just to give you some reference, Facebook monetizes at $8.52, right, globally. But in the United States, that monetization level is $41.
So even though YouTube's growing fast, it could still pull in plenty more. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Coming up,
transparency is so important in both the way people invest and the debt that they use to invest in it.
Malpass and Yellen part deux, straight ahead. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. All right, here you go. Dow Industrial is up 407 points, 1.4%, 28,807. The NASDAQ advanced 194 points. That is 2.1%, 94.67. The S&P 500 found 48 points, 1.4%, 32.97 there. Nothing like a little bit of really loud, really happy music, huh? Sabri was telling us about YouTube's growth. Yeah, that's great, but Alphabet's overall revenues failed to meet expectations. Today, Alphabet clicked down 2.6%. Clorox, best known as the maker of bleach, etc., cleaned up 4.9%. Today, bonds fail. Yield on the 10-year T-note up to 1.60%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We are going to pick back up now with my conversation from this morning. David Malpass, the president of the World Bank, Janet Yellen, ex-chair of the Federal Reserve at the Bipartisan Policy Center here in Washington. We left off earlier with China and the coronavirus. We start here with China and trade.
I want to talk about trade for a minute, current state of play, and whether, David, you think the period of trade unpleasantness, shall we say, the past 18 months has been worth it.
Well, they've reached a deal, and I gather are still working on it. I'm not part of the administration, so I don't am not privy to that. I think there are clear objectives with China that that people are working on. One is the rules that involve intellectual property and so on. If progress can be made in that area, that's going to be good. And then also with China, part of what's going on, with the World Bank, we can work with them on ways to have more transparency within their development assistance programs. So I'll take a quick minute on that. Transparency is so important in both the way people invest and the debt that they use to invest in it. Economics shows us debt is basically good if it finances good investments. But to do that, you have to know what are the terms. And so China was this new player in the international sphere. Their economy went from, you know, 0 to 60 in terms of GDP growth and per capita income. And so as they did contracting in developing countries, they put in new terms into the contracts that don't work very well in the international system. So we're working to untangle the legal challenge. And again, I say China's working well with this, but it happened very quickly. The amounts that they're investing in developing countries skyrocketed.
To be clear, so, you're not saying that China's a paragon of transparency here, right?
They're not.
Okay.
And it would be good to have China join the world more in an international system that operates on, I don't want to say tight rules and regulations. I just want to say general standards of how these things operate. That's going to go a long way.
Janet, to the question of the president's tariffs and whether we are getting to where the president and his advisors have said we want to be. As I'm sure you remember, you and I spoke on Marketplace a year ago as the trade war was really getting going. And I asked you at one point if you thought the president understands macroeconomic policy. And as I'm equally sure you remember, you said, no, I don't. Do you still feel that way?
Well, with respect to tariffs, I think President Trump and some of his advisors are very focused about the magnitude of bilateral trade deficits and take that as a symptom of relationships being unfair and seek to really try to modify that. So I regarded that as not the proper focus. But let me be clear, I do think the United States has real issues in terms of its trade relations with China. I think it's healthy and a good thing for business confidence that there's been a truce in terms of escalation of tariffs between China and the United States. But still, lots of tariffs are in place, and importantly, they affect intermediate goods. When you look at businesses in the United States, if a motive for putting in place tariffs was to make U.S. manufacturers more competitive and to increase job prospects in manufacturing in the United States, I would say we haven't seen that. On the one hand, the tariffs afford some protection for U.S. manufacturers, but on the other hand, they serve as tariffs on intermediate inputs that are important to these same businesses. And overall, it seems to me that it's been a wash from the perspective of U.S. jobs, especially in manufacturing.
I bet that's the answer you wish you'd given last year, right?
That's right.
Yeah. There you go.
I guess I should have been prepared for that.
When we started, you both talked about the China slowdown and the European slowdown. David, who are you worried more about, Europe slowing down or China slowing down?
Well, the coronavirus is a new factor for China, and we'll see how they're dealing with it. So I think today we have to say the China slowdown. Mm-hmm. But if you'd asked me a month ago, I would have said the Europe, because its economy is bigger than, in combination, the Eurozone countries are bigger than China, and their growth rate is simply not adding to the world. So let me mention a little bit the World Bank goals. So World Bank works in specific areas in developing countries around the world to try to have better structural policies. So I think the solution is very firm transparency of the investments that they're making and the debts that they're taking on so that the public can better evaluate what they're getting.
Let me riff on that for a second. Do you think the American public understands the debt that we all owe? Jen, I'm going to give you that. Do you think the American public understands its debt?
I think the answer is no. I doubt that most people, for example, would know that the ratio of debt to GDP in the U.S. has doubled since the financial crisis. And I sometimes recommend to people who ask me about this topic, pick up the Congressional Budget Office's long-term budget projections and take a look. And the details change from year to year, but for more or less the last 20 years at least, what you see is the U.S. Debt path is completely unsustainable under current tax and spending plans. And I think is something that most people don't understand, and I see very little evidence of concern about it in recent years.
Janet Yellen, she used to chair the Federal Reserve. David Malpass is currently the president of the World Bank this morning here in Washington. More of our conversation at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, in which the phrase short squeeze plays a leading role. Shares of Tesla were up 23% at one point today. That's not for the month or even the week, but for the day, 23%. $960-ish a share was the high. There's lots of speculation that's short sellers. Remember, we did that interview last week about people betting Tesla shares are going to fall. Anyway, best guesses are that the spike is people who'd been betting the electric car maker's shares were going to fall having to scramble to cover their losses in the Tesla rally the past couple of months. Ticker symbol TSLA ended the day at $887 a share, up 13%. Kind of makes 420 funding secured seem quaint now, doesn't it? All right, we're out of here. Dow Industrials up 407 points today, 1.4%. The NASDAQ advanced 194 points. That is 2.1%. The S&P 548 points to the good, 1.4% there. Our digital and on-demand team includes Kerry Barber, Samantha Fields, Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, and Erica Phillips. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of on-demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.